plus one is seven, so there's seven parts in the economy, and the farm drives the whole thing here. If you don't eat, you don't work. You have to eat to work, and you have to work to eat. That's the idea. I mean, nobody gets free food. There's no free lunch. You can't, unless you're the fellow with the gun. You know, that's the way you get it. You either cheat or you work, one or the other. But anyway, these guys began to study, as Sue said, the price of the bushel of corn. And that's, let me move forward here. Really? Okay, all right. Yeah, he was talking about corn. Why did it sell for 50 cents one day and 20 cents a week later? We got all kinds of explanations over the years. Market forces, moon phases, you know, it's the shifting purchasing power of money, diminishing social utility. All these have been nominated as why the prices change. And what was discovered by these guys in researching the economic record was a part of the economic solution to the economic riddle. That's what they discovered. They were looking for it. They found it. And get my finger. Yeah, well, I came off the... Yeah, I need to define some terms here. Wealth and capital, if you'll notice, are pretty close to one another. This is not something that people understand today. Let me get out of the way so people can see that. The presentation that we saw upstairs for the main talk this afternoon was, you know, if I were to throw this brick through the window, it would be heat right back at it. This is not the stuff that economists like to hear or deal with. You know, when you start separating up physics versus mathematics and drawing the difference between what rots and what doesn't as to what's real and what matters in your life, generally it's not considered to be the economic level of argument. We're not dealing properly with the subject matter. So does anybody take issue with any of this stuff, Sarah?
What do you mean that wealth rots, rusts, and decays?
Because that's what it does. Money is not wealth. Money, not wealth. Wealth is not money. In other words, the wealth is, the word itself, it talks about the wheel of a nation, like the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, is a place where the folks who live in there, when it was founded, were contributing their energies so that the wheel, the well-being of the group living in that place were to lift each other up. Everybody contributes what they can to increase the wheel of the group. So that's where the word wealth comes from. Just like health comes from how hale are you?
Really good.
That's good. So you have health. Well, wheel and wealth are the same. You know, in other words, it's a group phenomenon rather than an individual. But the wealth is not a bank account balance.
You mean physical wealth, really, don't you?
I mean wealth.
Like houses, clothes, food.
Yeah. Well, name me something that you think is wealth.
What about know-how?
Education, skill. To do what?
Usually they include know-how and capital, actually.
I understand, yeah. But I can have know-how if I know how to put this screen up, but I don't do it, what good is my know-how? So what's the wealth? Me knowing how or putting the screen up?
Having the screen.
Exactly. We want the screen up, so if somebody can put the screen up, then that's... So know-how may be a good thing for you to have, but only because you can do something with it. You affect the world around you. We live in this world. It's a physical world. Here it is. And the stuff that... Look at this room. You know, the carpet on the floor, the computers sitting here, all of this stuff, it's all started out as raw materials. And not only did it start out as raw materials, but the people who put it together had to eat 3 meals a day while they were working to invent this stuff and put it together and sell it to you and me and bring it here and put it all together so that we can share words. That's what I mean by physical wealth. It rots. It rusts and it decays. And that's important because we have to replace it.
Mm-hmm.
It's a flow of energy. This building is falling down. Slowly, imperceptibly. Somebody has to come in and sweep the floor. Or it's going to fall down faster. They're going to have to replace the carpet soon. You know, the lights burn out. All of this stuff. That's wealth.
Mm-hmm.
That's what we're talking about. We're talking about wealth, real wealth. And money is only a claim on that wealth. It's how we get wealth. If I earn money, I have contributed my energy to my community. And my community says, thank you. Here, we don't know what you want, but we'll give you some tokens that you can pick whatever you want from what we've got. We aren't going to make that decision for you. We're going to let you decide. Now, capital is wealth, but it's aimed at other uses. Capital is the product of labor, and as Lincoln said, deserves much the higher consideration. Labor deserves much the higher consideration. So in that point, your know-how idea, you know, is important. I don't mean to minimize it, but it's still to do something in the physical world. We are... These are bodies. They suck air and eat food and drink water. And if they don't have a place they can let some of that out, why, we get sick.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to take care of all that stuff. It's physicality. So money is the claim on wealth, but it's not wealth. Parity, what we talk about here is equal exchange value between the segments of the economy. What we use is Simon Kuznets' breakdown of national income. Kuznets was a Nobel Prize-winning economist who laid out an early version of national income, national wealth accounting. And he called it the national income accounting. And he broke the economy into 6 segments, and we'll get to some of that later here. But this country was, you know, we started off with this thing here.
You're running a bit low on time.
Okay, I will hurry up. Thank you. Let's see here. One of our understandings is that the United States was intended to establish a chance, a place, a spot on this earth where we could move beyond old world habits and beliefs. And that's one of the things that signified this start of that. The opportunity to improve one's own condition in life through one's own labor and applied intelligence. At first, our own labor, you know, it was a condition narrowly applied white male property owners. But, you know, blood, suffering, and some blessed guidance, we've slowly broadened the scope of those words in our Declaration of Independence. Mm-hmm. We got a long way to go yet, but we're teetering on the cusp now whether we'll take our responsibilities seriously to these words or whether we'll give up. Let the purveyors of privilege ruin what was so courageously begun here. But the goal of our analysis is to identify the characteristics of prosperity and propose policies which enable and encourage such activity. What may be good for an individual may not be good for a community, but we are social beings, and so we've got to work together to figure out what's best for the greatest number of all concerned. That's what it seems like to me. Big thing here is the money section in the Constitution. That's where we start, and it's, you know, the, is anybody not familiar with that? I think we all know what that one's about here in this group. Coin money and regulate the value thereof and of foreign coin. Does anybody know how the United States was supposed to regulate the value of foreign coin? They wrote it in there. They must have known what they were talking about. No? Nobody knows what that is?
Bank actions, buying and selling.
No, actually what they were talking about, there was tariffs.
Yeah, tariffs. Right.
That's how you regulate the value of foreign coin.
Correctly, yep.
But that was what was in their head. Let's see. Oh, I ran away again. Now, they also prohibit the states, of course, from emitting bills of credit, coin money, for all the rest of that stuff. The solution to the economic riddle that I mentioned before, it's found in the twin effects of the properly monetized raw material production. Everything begins with the raw materials, like I said. As soon as, in fact, civilization will wink out of existence in two generations between high civilization and Stone Age existence. Two generations. And it will come when the raw materials no longer hit the factories. When nobody's delivering soybeans or corn or iron ore or silica or crude oil for jet fuel refining, you know, things stop. That's what it comes down to. So when that raw material production comes into being and is put on the market, that's when two things happen. We wind up with the wealth that comes into the market, and the amount that's paid for it begins the income process that moves that oil, in this case, through the processor, through the refiner, through the pipeline to the consumers who can buy it up, put it in their planes, get someplace they want to go. So the price per unit of crude oil times the number of units produced of crude oil gives you the gross income of the crude oil producers in a one-year time. That number has to be enough.
Come on the other side because you're blocking the
light. Sorry. I'm killing off my own. I'm not talking about this. I'm just talking about the raw material and the flow of income. This right here is the breakdown of Kuznets' national income. And what I've got here is, this is the 1947 to 49 average, which is a parity base period for the 20th century. There are three parity base periods in the 20th century, 1910 to 14, 1925 to 29, and 1947 to 49. Actually, the whole period here was from 1942 through 1952. But we choose a chunk that is not associated with a wartime economy. But these were the ratios. These are the actual numbers here. But here's, we've got the shares. In other words, wages, salaries, and supplements was 68% of national income. Net interest was 3.8% of national income. Corporate profits before tax were 13.7% of national income. Rental incomes to persons, and that includes trademarks and patents, 4.8, small business or unincorporated business, 9.5, net farm, 0.3%. These are the percentage of shares of national income in 2017. That's what this number is right across here. Now, when you add up these four numbers, you come out with this, and when you add these two numbers, you come out with this, because this is the 2017 comparison between the cost side and the revenue side, and that's 71.72 to 28%. And what we find out is that if you actually put the numbers down here, this number up here for the 47 to 49 parity period, this becomes 66 and this becomes 33. That's what balance in our economy looked like. Two-thirds cost, one-third revenue. And we're way beyond now, from 66 to almost 72, we got 6% skewed of cost compared to revenue. We aren't generating enough income to support the costs in our economy. And so what we're doing here is, what we point out, is that particularly net farm, well, not net farm, wait, community insurance, gross farm income. I mean, if you don't generate a gross, you can't have much of a net. So we point out that the every month, USDA publishes parity prices, and nobody does anything with them.
Randy, just define a parity price.
Yeah, equal exchange value. That's what I said earlier. That was the, one of the definitions, was equal exchange value. In other words, the buying power of agriculture is on par with or equal to the buying power of any of those other segments of the economy. The wealth we produce is sufficient wealth. The dollar that the farmer gets at 100 cents means he's getting a parity price. If the farmer is getting a 30% parity share of the national income, that means that when he gets paid for his wheat, the price he receives is 30 cents on the dollar. He's getting a 30-cent dollar in his and can't pay his bills because a 30-cent dollar doesn't buy very much. And that's really where the situation is today. And then what we say is that if we were to run that up to 100% of parity, then agriculture would be able to pull its weight. The nation would earn its income. We don't have to borrow the money to finance growth or payments of any kind anywhere. The shortage of farm income, gross farm income, look at that number. That's $40 trillion.
Randy, do you
want to
get to the equitable trade?
Well, yeah, I can talk about equitable trade.
Well, we have 5 minutes before the session ends.
Okay. Prospering in our own nation, we've got to have both domestic income and we've got to have some way of dealing with purchases or sales across our borders. And so what we've done in the past is the buying power of our money, this is what we're talking about here, by parity agricultural policy, which we did for 2 years after the war by statute, and it wound up working for another 5 years actually after the war, was that it regulates the value of money. Parity agriculture regulates the value of the U.S. dollar to better than 100% accuracy. Well, it did this for 12 years in a row. And so in order to be able to do equitable trade across our borders, that's what parity tariffs will do. What it means is that it's a self-adjusting tariff. We know the value of the products we're importing compared to what it takes to produce them here. So we simply strike a line, we calculate what number we need, what we should have paid for what we've imported, because generally they're cheaper imports, and we know what we should have paid ourselves for doing the same, producing the same wealth, and that's what we add to the imported price. It develops what's called economic skin, so we don't bleed to death with a bunch of imported material that either undercuts our quality or ruins our ability to produce anything of a similar nature. Mm-hmm. Okay. Curiously, the law regarding agriculture is still in effect, still on the books. Title 7, USC 601 and 602. Been there since 1933. This is the agricultural parity ratio from 1952, last time we had 100% of parity in agriculture. this little hump right in here is the what they call the Russian grain deal, which really had nothing to do with Russian grain. It was a money deal. That was when Nixon closed the gold window in August of 71. And so foreign powers, particularly the French and the Russians, had lots of Federal Reserve notes that they had been bringing to the Fed window and converting them to gold, taking gold home. And Nixon closed the gold window and said, no, you're not going to do that anymore. So they had the only thing they could take away was something we had lots of, which was wheat and soybeans. So the Russians bought lots of wheat and soybeans, and it pushed the price up to about 82% of parity.
Wow.
For a short time. One of the other things I should point out is that the recent housing, well, 11 years ago, 2008, the housing bubble burst. One of the things that happened was some of the people who had money in the stock market wanted to put it into a safer place. So they moved some of their investments, illegally actually, because they were not eligible to participate in commodity futures trading. But some of the banks they knew worked out a deal where they'd take their money out of the stock market and stick it into the futures market for ag commodities. And it pushed up the ag parity ratio from about 34 to about 42% in the course of about 8 months. And then it stayed there for about another 10 months before it began to fade and the money came out of the futures market and the whole thing kind of went back down to where it is now, which is at 30% parity ratio. But that little bit of rise through the agricultural multiplier gave the economic analysts a thought, an inkling. They thought they saw in all these tea leaves that the economy was actually recovering. That's what led everybody to think we were coming out of the recession. It was false information, of course. It didn't last very long. But that's the power of what this stuff does. It's not a theory.
Can you explain the multiplier?
Yeah, we've got if there's a few, if anyone has some questions for any of the speakers, it's burning. Now's the time before we have to...
And I apologize to the other speakers for sucking up your time for questions, so please forgive me.
Thanks very much. Sure. Any questions, anyone? The American Monetary Institute has a conference every year, and we have to have all of the speakers that are here, plus Professor Paul Davidson, at our conference. It's October 3rd to 6th in Chicago, at University Center in Chicago, October 3rd to 6th. And there's some spare flyers at the back of the room if you want to take to remind you. And there's the AMI's website, monetary.org, is there, and you can find out more about the conference coming up soon. And you can also find our email address there. And if you would like to get a copy of any of the presentations that you saw today, or you have any other questions, mm-hmm. you can email us and we'll pass those that information on to you. So any burning questions before we close up?
I thought I'd ask Howie, how come the phrase in the 19th century kept changing names as the same people?
Okay, well, the American political parties, they're the first parties to have conventions. But they didn't have members, so they evolved like the Whigs and the Tories in England, where you had a House of Commons, and they were based on landed people, the commoners, they didn't have a vote originally. And as the franchise gradually expanded, or just in the competition among the landed elites, the Whigs and the Tories, their wealthy people would support the candidates. And so the whole structure kind of developed from the top down. You didn't have a membership with rights in the organization. The labor parties, the socialist parties in Europe developed that in the second half of the 19th century. The populists did not. The Socialist Party of Debs did, partly having learned what happened, because what happened in 1896, you had the real populists who were based on the farmers' alliances. They already had membership organizations. They elected delegates, but then from the states where you didn't really have those farmers' alliances, it was opportunistic Republicans or Democrats that wanted to fuse, do fusion, like we do here in New York. And they were able to get the nomination for Bryan against the real populace. Just like
Teddy Roosevelt got one, the primaries are just being introduced. He went on to primaries in 1912, but Taft got all the votes from the southern machine of Republicans, where the Republicans didn't even have ballot lines. So it was controlled from the top down rather from the bottom up. And I would say, so they, when they, every 4 years, they'd call for precinct conventions, which would elect county delegates, and then state delegates and national delegates. And then once they had a convention, there was no organization. So they had to come back together, and, you know, they thought some rebranding would be good, you know, each every 4 years. That's the way I understand it.
Any more questions for any of the speakers? Sue?
I wanted Randy to explain the multiplier.
Okay.
The parity multiplier.
Well, that most takes more time than we have.
What?
Well, no, it's just there is the multiplier. There is most every segment of the economy has a circulating multiplier. It the earnings that come out of that segment will flow through the rest of the economy certain multiple of times.
Uh-huh.
That's really what we talk about having discovered was the 7 times multiplier of the ag income. So that for every dollar that ag earns gross, it generates about 7 times the number of dollars in the rest of the economy.
Okay. Thank you. Great.